7th episode of Reverse Web Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's 140 years to the day since Fred the Demon Spofford took the first hat-trick in Test cricket history against England at Melbourne. Welcome to the podcast. Delighted to know that even then, the tradition of the English batting claps was already well established.
And Reverse Web Radio looking to establish ourselves in this new year of 2019. Happy New Year to everyone listening. It's, what, the 3rd of January or something now. We're looking forward to another year full of cricketing delight. And in this episode, we are going to be talking about all the Test cricket that's happening at the moment. A lot of Test cricket happening around the world, which has been making us very happy indeed. I'm going to be diving back into the archives to talk about matting wickets and what matting wickets are actually made of. And then we're going to review Alan Butcher's book, The Good Murungu. And we're going to start that review by revealing what Murungu actually means. So, Andy, it's been cold, it's been miserable, it's been Christmas in the UK, and you've been keeping yourself alive by browsing the pages of Crick Info.
Well, it is the, you know, it's the season to be jolly, but it is also the season to get genuinely overwhelmed by the sheer quantity of Test cricket going on. The New Zealand-Sri Lanka series was kind of an interesting one in terms of a Sri Lanka team come off a tough defeat by England and a New Zealand team that had just won in Pakistan. The first test seemed over pretty much as day three came to its end. Sri Lanka 13 for 3, 283 needed just to make their hosts bat again. Kusal Mendes and Angelo Matthews were facing a real barrage of short balls. They survived, and as pictures of Angelo Matthews would testify to, they survived with quite a few bruises and blows, but they got there. But they still faced what looked like basically an impossible ask. You know, 2 days of the game still to go, and already 3 wickets down. But somehow, what happened next may go down as sort of as great an escape as I think I've seen in Test cricket. They batted for the whole of the fourth day. They then batted for just 52 minutes. That was always that was required on a rain-affected fifth day, without losing a single wicket. And I think to put this into context, what was so impressive is that this was the Sri Lankan team. There's not much tail end going on here. You know, Mendes and Matthews knew that if Sri Lanka were going to pull this off, it really had to be them. They'd already lost, you know, 3 of their top order colleagues against a New Zealand bowling attack with plenty. And I think the other thing was just the sheer sort of hopelessness of the situation. And yet they came out and they believed. A huge amount of credit to New Zealand and Kane Williamson, who I thought there's been a lot written about sort of the right spirit and how you play the game. And Kane Williamson was a very, very gracious, not gracious in defeat, but, you know, gracious in the draw by saying just how in awe the New Zealand team were of the way Mendes and Matthews had stepped up.
And it's really something to actually take pride in I suppose it requires you to take pride in being able to bat out several days to be able to actually achieve that. You know, you have to really go, I am succeeding by doing this, not just I'm not losing by doing this almost. I mean, it reminds me of those kind of, you know, those football matches. I was about to say soccer matches because that's what we call it in Australia. But, you know, those ones that are, you know, kind of the draws where it's a really kind of relentless defensive game where you know, everyone's fighting to the last minute. And there was something about that in this game as well. Just that mindset required to say, I'm going to bat for however many days and just see this through, which is something that apparently doesn't exist in Test cricket anymore, we're always told.
Exactly that. And I think it's even more impressive with two players. So Matthews, who, of course, burst onto the scene as this kind of hard-hitting, all-action all-rounder. And Kusal Mendes, who has this reputation, again, as a sort of flamboyant stroke player. And it comes back to it again and again, this thing, doesn't it, where we talk about, you know, play your natural game, et cetera, et cetera. But, of course, there's something even more impressive. You know, there's one thing when Paul Collingwood pulled off a great escape, when you knew that was Collingwood's
game. That was
game,
in his blood,
you know,
yeah.
Back to the wall. It was what he, you know, it was what he lived for, what he played the game for. But there's something, in a way, more impressive, actually, about a Mendes or a Matthews sort of doing it for pride. And also, I think a huge amount of credit to, again, a sort of New Zealand team who on that fourth day sort of tried everything. You know, poor Kane Williamson was sort of, he tried sort of every plan in the book. It's not as if New Zealand kind of just went along with this. But in that sense, it makes the achievement even more memorable.
One of the things that's been really interesting about watching the India-Australia series, as I have been over the last little while, is watching Pujara bat, because he's someone who can be a pretty flash player in the one day in the 2020 arena, but you get him out onto a test pitch and he is just happy to bat and bat and bat in the way that he did, for instance, in the Boxing Day Melbourne test. The way that he just seemed to be able to switch his mindset and just be able to say, this is a completely different game, I need to do something totally different here, was really impressive, I thought.
Yeah, and I think that whole series, which you have been watching very, very closely, is, three tests in, has all the makings, I think, of a kind of genuine classic.
It is a classic, yeah, and the really happy thing for me has been the fact that it's coincided with my actually having a bit of holiday. Because usually, you know what it's like, when you're following the test cricket in the office, and you try to move all your meetings so that they're, you know, before 10:30 in the morning or after 6 o'clock in the evening, but inevitably, unfortunately, sometimes you have to actually get on and do some work, and so you end up kind of following the score here or there, and you know, getting cricket info up on your desktop and things like that, but it's not quite the same in terms of being able to follow the rhythm of the game. I've had a bit of time off over Christmas, and so particularly for the Boxing Day test from Melbourne, that the two teams went into one all, I've actually been able to dedicate whole days to watching the cricket. My partner's been at work, so I haven't had any distractions on that front. And so I've confined myself purely to doing tasks that I can do while the cricket is playing in the radio on the background. So, you know, I'll get up in the morning, do a bit of DIY around the house while listening to the radio, go for a long, lazy pub lunch and watch the cricket there. And there is a particular joy that comes from actually pacing your entire day through cricket, not simply because I'm lazy, although listeners are probably getting that impression, but also because you actually realise what the true measure of a match is, in the way that you don't sometimes if you check in at the back of the end of the day and see the scorecard. And this MCG match was a case in point, because you know, in the first couple of days it looked like it was just going to be heading for being a really slow draw. India were, you know, scraping out 400 odd runs for the loss of 7 wickets very, very slowly. You know, Pujara scored, you know, took something like 380 balls to reach his century. It was really slow going, and then suddenly it all changed with that rush of wickets in the second half of the match. But so many of those little ebbs and flows that happened within the game that you don't actually really know about unless you're following it through were really spectacular. You know, particularly that moment at the end of the Australian first innings when Bumrah, who I'd never actually seen bowl in the flesh, I mean, there's someone with hope for all of us. There's a man with a shocking bowling action, let's face it. But what he can do with the ball is just absolutely, you know, mind-boggling. So, you know, I've just been very glad over the last little while that I haven't been in the office and I've been able to actually, you know, soak up some of this exactly as you say, what is looking like it's going to be a pretty vintage series.
I think it, you're absolutely right that it is one of the great joys of following test or just long form cricket, that you can follow it from a distance. You can do the sort of thing, the office kind of checking in, drifting out, grabbing bits of commentary. And there's a pleasure to that. You know, as you say, you go for a meeting, come back and England have lost 5 wins.
Yeah, exactly.
That drama is always fun. And then you swear that you won't go, you won't leave the computer again for the rest of the day, because, you know, if they do, there'll be another collapse. But yes, that rare luxury, which I guess inevitably only comes around a few times a year, where you can actually just fully immerse yourself, is quite something. From the archives, and this episode, Toby is going to tell us about how you weave a cricket pitch.
So one of the joys about cricket is that it truly can be played almost anywhere. we had quite a lot of experiences at university of playing, playing corridor cricket for countless hours. And in one particular share house that we had, there was a shot that, you know, threaded the needle between the stairs and the balustrade on the other side that was, you know, between kind of the bowler and mid off. And that was hit the kitchen door and it was the defining shot. So really any surface can be adapted to a game of cricket. You know, you've got beach cricket tournaments all over the world. There's that match that's played on the sandbar in the Thames, I think, when the tide's in the right place every summer. And then there's that beautiful book by Harry Pearson about playing cricket up on the Antarctic or Arctic or anyway somewhere with some snow. Now one of the things that I've always wondered about and encountered a lot in cricket literature has been around matting wickets. And matting wickets were one of the things that were invented in the late part of the 19th century, again, to allow cricket to be played in circumstances in which it usually couldn't be played, in places where you could not grow a grass pitch. Now, not necessarily on the beach or any of those other examples that I've given, but mostly in the subcontinent and in the West Indies as well. Now, as I say, you read really any cricket book written before the 1960s, and there will be a lot of references to matting wickets. And I'd never actually really known what a matting wicket was, so I decided for this podcast to take a little bit of a trip into that and have a look at what a matting wicket really is. So the matting itself that we're talking about here is made of something called coir. I think that's how it's pronounced. I don't actually have any idea. It's spelled C-O-I-R, which is coconut fibre. So basically coconut leaves dried out and stripped down. Or it's made out of jute, which is the same thing from vegetables. And these are woven together essentially into a mat, which covers the strip. And it's laid, rather than being laid directly on top of earth, it's either laid on sawdust or it's laid on cinders.
And presumably this was at least originally a sort of handmade operation. This is done sort of much more mechanically, but I guess originally this was something that would just be, you know, you'd get local friends of the cricket club to mat you a wicket.
Exactly. And certainly there are quite a lot of descriptions. I think it's in Beyond the Boundary, actually. There are descriptions of the people who are employed to actually mend the wickets as well, because obviously once you've created one of these things, they do get worn out, you know, just as you get worn out in the bowler's footmarks on a grass wicket, for instance. And so you have to have people who are actually on hand to mend these things. And partly because it's usually handmade, as you say, and partly also because of the nature of matting and weaving, it's actually a really unpredictable surface. So every single matting wicket is different. And also because it's woven, it's not even at all, and that means that when you're bowling on it, the ball can deviate in any direction. It can either deviate side to side, or it can, you know, rear up from a length or keep low, depending on where exactly it hits any particular kind of grain of the thread that's going through it.
So what's quite confusing about this is you've gone to a lot of effort, presumably, to create this amount. And as you say, there is a maintenance thing as well. I mean, I guess as there is with any pitch. And yet you've done all this to create a surface that, as you say, is quite chaotic. It's just kind of interesting where, I don't know, if you think of, it's obviously a much more 21st century comparison, but you think of something like the AstroTurf pitches that more and more clubs have gone to. And, you know, maybe that's an episode for us in the future. But where you do that because it is so predictable, it is so reliable. But it's fascinating to go to all this effort to create a surface that remains a nightmare for the batsman.
Yeah, and I think the point is that it's less of a nightmare than it would be to, for instance, be in India on a pitch with no grass on it, which had rained and then the sun had come out and it had massive cracks in it. So I think it's kind of the lesser of two evils in that regard. I think the other thing is it just stops the pitch from being worn down as quickly as it otherwise would be. So whilst it's unpredictable, it's not as unpredictable as a, you know, uncovered pitch in somewhere with a fairly extreme climate, particularly a climate that's both, you know, wet and hot at the same time. The way that matting wickets make cricketers play is quite distinctive. And again, if you read cricket literature from the first part of the 20th century, you hear a lot about people whose stroke play was forged on matting wickets. And one of the characteristics of that is that batsmen who have grown up on matting wickets generally play the ball a lot later, because they're not quite sure where the bounce is going to be, particularly against quicker bowling. And so hitting wristily behind square, particularly on the offside, is something that's a real trademark of batsmen, particularly subcontinental batsmen. And that's why, you know, wristy cutting is something that's such a trademark of subcontinental batsmen. The other thing that's quite distinctive is that batsmen on matting wickets would tend to come down the pitch against spinners, because matting actually takes spin very, very well. It's quite a quick wicket. The ball can grip quite well on it. And so the number one concern in the batsman's mind was always getting as close to the bounce as they possibly could, in order to smother that spin, because otherwise, you know, a spin bowler bowling a good length could be really, really hard to play against. There are a lot of stories about games played on matting wickets, but there are a couple that I think give some quite interesting illustrations of the surface. One of which is when Australia toured Pakistan in 1958. And I mean, it really harks back to a different era, when an international side could go to play a test series and turn up and actually be playing on a surface different from what they expected. So they turned up expecting to play on turf, and when they turned up, actually the pitches or matting pitches that they were being asked to play on. I mean, it's like nowadays, you know, England going to Australia for the Ashes and suddenly, sorry guys, you're on AstroTurf, you know. It's quite a significant difference. Now, the reason Pakistan did this was probably tactical. They had a lot of quicks who were very suited to these slightly sort of wobbly surfaces, and Australia ended up getting absolutely thrashed. One interesting detail is that the groundskeepers in Pakistan actually put pebbles under the matting. So they had the ground, which had a whole lot of you know, dips and bumps in it, and they actually put pebbles into these bumps to try and even them out, and then put the matting on top of the pebbles. Now, the result of this is that whenever the ball hit one of these pebbles, it would just fly off at a completely different, you know, angle. And so suddenly you had these poor batsmen who had balls rearing up at them off a length and you know, hitting their fingers and going all over the place. So suddenly you had matting wickets, which were quite unpredictable, being made totally unpredictable by what was hiding underneath them as well.
It has extraordinary potential for sort of pitch manipulation, because it's one thing, obviously, trying to do dubious things to a sort of grass, you know, turf wicket. But actually, you know, if Pakistan finished batting and then it's Australia's turn to bat, and the Pakistani groundsman sort of, you know, I'm not obviously not saying this happened, but ran out and suddenly, you know, as you say, shifted a few pebbles around and things under the matting, you know, you could presumably transform. You could always transform the behaviour of the wicket.
Well, and it's certainly the case that you could water matting wickets, because if you think of what a piece of matting would behave differently if it was soaking wet from when it was dry, obviously it's quite a considerable difference. It's going to slow down significantly if it's got some water in it. And so when you have home sides having the prerogative over how you can, you know, treat a pitch, as you say, there were significant opportunities to be able to think, okay, well, we've got an attack that suits this kind of a pitch. Now we can really tailor the pitch to do this. Now, matting wickets started dying out in the latter part of the 20th century, and by the 1970s, they were pretty rare, certainly in professional cricket. Now, you still get in the 21st century, you still get matting wickets being used in amateur cricket all over the world, simply because they allow you to play on almost any quality of surface. But in the 1970s, they were dying out. But actually, interestingly, the first games in World Series cricket in Australia were played on matting wickets. And what this meant was that in this new kind of fairly flash, you know, smash 'em and hope for the best form of cricket, wickets fell really quickly. And the reason that they used matting wickets was because the wickets were falling quickly and the game became more watchable, which is actually really interesting when you think about the 2020 and the some of the developments that have happened there, in terms of wanting to, yes, put some power in the hands of the batsman, but also to make sure that the bowlers, it's not, you know, it's not just 300 being scored every single innings along the way. So, as I say, massing wickets had largely died out by the 1970s. Interestingly, I was reading a story the other day that was talking about Aravinda De Silva, the great Sri Lankan batsman, and small piece of trivia, my hero as a cricketer growing up after Sri Lanka's win in the World Cup in 1996, that Aravinda De Silva wants to introduce matting wickets back into school pitches in Sri Lanka, because he's saying that actually the really kind of docile turf pitches that they have at the moment is not developing players in the way that they need to be developed. That actually, if you bring back matting wickets, the wickets are quicker, people develop their reactions more because they're more unpredictable as well. So it may be that in the case of matting wickets, history may yet come full circle.
Have you ever played on one?
I've never played on a matting wicket. Have you?
No. Well, this whole feature has made me think I'd be very, very curious to. It does sound like, as you say, a kind of very, very different experience.
I was in Oman a couple of years ago and saw a cricket game that was being played on some matting wickets. And, you know, baking hot day, 45 degrees, an oval that didn't have a patch of grass on it. And there was a matting wicket there, but no, I've never come across one. Maybe this is what we need to do. Maybe we need to organise a matting wicket match at some point and really test this all out. So, the review. And for this episode, we have been reading The Good Murungu, A Cricket Tale of the Unexpected by Alan Butcher. Now, Murungu is a Zimbabwean word in the Zimbabwean Shona language, meaning white man. And the good Murungu is what Alan Butcher's housekeeper calls him at one point, meaning he's a good white man. And as he says in the foreword to this book, I must leave it to the reader to decide if the accolade was deserved. Now, this book tells the story of Alan Butcher's 3 years coaching Zimbabwe. Alan Butcher, probably most famous, maybe this is an unfair way of putting it, but possibly most famous for being the father of the England batsman Mark Butcher. But Alan Butcher in himself, a very distinguished coached Surrey for a while and then went off to coach Zimbabwe. And this book talks about his time in the country and also his mostly frustrations and some of the joys of coaching Zimbabwe in the early 2000s, I think I'm right in saying is the period that this covers. Now, Andy, what did you learn about Zimbabwean cricket from this book?
I think you got a very good sense of what it was like to be in Zimbabwean cricket post the sort of golden age. So I think there was that extraordinary time when Zimbabwe came onto the test scene. You have the Andy Flower, Heath Streaks, Grant Flowers of this world, where Zimbabwe for a few years, you know, really traded blows with the best. You know, they're very, very strong.
They were going to be the great success story, and they were the underdogs who were making it good.
Yeah, and I think you look at that team in its prime, and they could stand and compete with anyone in Test cricket. And I think Alan Butcher came into this situation, as I guess all Zimbabwean coaches have since that time, of having that golden age hanging over them, but having to create a competitive team at a time when actually the players just weren't really there. You know, Butcher is very sort of honest and frank at times in the book, saying, you know, you can only measure your success against sort of what you've got. You know, he was desperately looking for, you know, the next great player on the domestic scene. But for the most part, it was a job of improving what he had.
Well, that was something that was quite interesting. The number of times he comes out, and it is a very honest book, or it seems to be a very honest book in the sense that it's not particularly polished, and he certainly lets his opinions be known. But there are a couple of times where he comes out and he just says, look, as a coach of a national side, in reality, you just depend on how good the players are. And there just simply were not enough good players in order to make an internationally competitive side. And so often you feel like that's what it comes down to. And, you know, towards the end of his 3-year stint, when they go to the West Indies, who certainly were not a great team by that stage. And it's something like in 2 2020s and 2 test matches, they make more than 50 runs twice as an entire team. And you suddenly think, wow, that must have really felt like banging your head against a brick wall. But there were also aspects of the kind of setup, fundamental aspects of the setup of Zimbabwean cricket as well, that I think sort of stack the odds against him.
I think particularly this idea of just finances. So I think one thing that is very hard to appreciate until you've read something like this is how on earth do you get your team to focus on their personal development, on getting onto the pitch in the best possible condition when they're worried about if they can pay to come to training. And I think the starkness of that poverty, frankly, of the Zimbabwean cricket board at that stage, I think is something that wasn't clear. It's also this challenge. I found it a fascinating insight just into coaching. I think there's a lot written about cricket coaching, you know, this difference between, are you developing players? Are you effectively just a strategist? And he talks about going to this team meeting quite shortly after he arrives and how the players sit there staring at their feet for half an hour, never asked for their opinion. And he desperately tries to change his culture. He wants players to sort of own it and, you know, be aware of their strategies, their approaches. But he's very honest about how hard that is. If you've got a team culture that's been based on, right, go out, do this, no questions asked, then trying to turn it into a more sort of collaborative, what do you think environment, was hard going.
Yeah, and one of the things that was quite interesting about that was the fact that he was trying to involve them in conversations, not just about, oh, the third ball of the over, you've bowled two outswingers, should you bowl an inswinger, but actually trying to involve them in conversations about where should we as an organisation be going and how do we want Zimbabwean cricket as a whole to, you know, to be, which I thought was really interesting, actually trying to engage the players with that kind of breadth of concern around the cricket, particularly given that there are so many indications throughout the book that the setup of Zimbabwean cricket at the time and possibly still revolves around the idea that you have a number of very powerful people at the top, of whom the coach actually, interestingly, is not one. And one of the reasons why he ends up kind of throwing in the towel is because he's just kind of pushed out of all selection decisions and he really, you know, continually has his authority undermined. So a very hierarchical thing where ultimately the players are just the people very much at the bottom of the ladder. And he really tries to turn that around. One thing that's interesting is the moment, and slightly depressing, is the moment where, as you say, the cricketers can't really focus on cricket, a lot of them, because they are the primary breadwinners in their families. And some of them just can't afford to come to wherever the training camp is. And so at one point he says to a couple of very promising young cricketers, look, just come and sleep on my floor. If it's the difference between your being here or not being here, you can just sleep on the floor of my flat. And the authorities just say flat out to him, the cricket authorities, that is just not appropriate. You just cannot do that. If they can't be here, then they can't be there, and it's not your place to try and kind of reverse that almost kind of social structure that they're sitting within.
Well, he has a lovely phrase where he talks about the politics of his situation was difficult, I think, in lots of ways. But he has this particularly bizarre situation where he had in his coaching team three people who had applied for the head coach job and understandably all thought they should have got it. And he has this lovely phrase where he describes the members of this golden age of Zimbabwe cricket as the professors of negativity. And I think it shows a particular approach to team building that I think has for most of the way sort of gone by the wayside, where a lot of these people just, if Zimbabwe lose, the problem is the team aren't tough enough. You've got to be tougher with them. You've got to, you know, tell them hard truths and this sort of thing. Whereas I think, not surprisingly, I think as a reader, you have a lot more sympathy for Butcher, who is realistic about what you can achieve. And is also, it's this weird mix of, as quite rightly, as you said, it's including players in the strategy and everything. But sometimes he's getting really into the weeds of technical coaching. You know, he talks about having to work with players. And frankly, I found that a real eye-opener, because my assumption's always been, if you're coaching at Test cricket, then frankly, you know, the players are pretty much there technique-wise. You know, you're maybe making the odd suggestion. But he talks about getting back to some real fundamentals.
Here's how you do the long barrier.
Yeah. I mean, it's some real fundamentals with the side. I was going to say, it's also a travel book, isn't it? You know, this is also a book about very much a coaching memoir. And I think quite rightly, as you said, a very honest and frank coaching memoir. But it is also a bit of a love letter to Zimbabwe. And I think I was lucky enough to spend a few years there as a child. And I think for me, I think it brought back a lot of nostalgia. And I think it's that lovely balance that there are times when Alan Butcher is quite understandably sick of the politics, frustrated with progress elsewhere, and then is redeemed by a wonderful experience in the country itself.
So I have to say, I also found it a very readable book, actually. It's not the most polished piece of prose that you'll ever see. It is, you know, Alan Butcher's forte is in cricket, not in writing. And I don't mean that in a particularly derogatory way, because actually, even though it's not polished, it's actually very readable and very engaging. It's kind of 250 pages long, 300 pages long almost. But it's the kind of thing you can kind of rip through in an afternoon, given the right circumstance and the right beverage at your arm.
So it's that's a funny example on ghostwriting, you know, because you read some biographies that are so polished. So I have a particular memory of reading an Andrew Flintoff one. I think he's got several now. And it was a very pleasant read, but frankly, I don't think Andrew Flintoff had ever seen a page of this book. You know, it was so polished. And obviously there's something good in having a book that's been well organized by a good journalist. But I think there is absolutely something in letting someone be very frank, very open. And actually, if they want to meander and tell you that very long anecdote, let them, you know, if that's what they judge important from their time.
Meander and tell long anecdotes. It might be something that could be said of Reverse Web Radio as well. So that was The Good Morungu, A Cricket Tale of the Unexpected by Alan Butcher. And that was the 107th episode of Reverse Web Radio, and that was my chair creaking. Thank you for listening. Happy New Year, as we say. Here's to a year of 2019 full of cricketing spectacle and success. As ever, please do head over to iTunes and leave us a review and maybe even a star rating. If it's going to be a nice review or a nice star rating, otherwise write it on a bit of paper and put it in a bottle in the ocean. And we will be back in another couple of weeks.